Hola, bonjour, hello. Let me ask you a question. Do you think it's possible to have a world language class where instead of teaching the language, the rules, and the vocab, you and your students use the language to enjoy learning about each other and the world? I hope your answer is a big yes, because that's exactly what you will discover inside Growing with Proficiency, the podcast. My name is Claudia Elliott, a Spanish teacher born and raised in Colombia, who is as passionate as you are to support our learners to grow in their proficiency and cultural competence. My goal is that in this podcast you find clarity, strategies, ideas, and inspiration that you can bring into your classroom the next day. Are you ready? Get comfortable while I grab my cafecito colombiano and let's start this conversation now. Hola, bonjour, hello. Welcome to a new episode of Growing with Proficiency, the podcast. Today, I'm honored to have Dr. Stephen Krashen with me to talk about second language acquisition, maybe a little bit about coffee and everything in between. Even though Dr. Krashen doesn't need an introduction, I'd like to share with you a little bit about him. Dr. Krashen is a linguistic researcher and educator known for his impactful work in second language acquisition and bilingual education. After receiving his PhD in linguistics from UCLA, he now serves as an emeritus professor of education at the University of Southern California. Dr. Krashen has made substantial contributions to our understanding of how people acquire languages. His work, such as the acquisition learning hypothesis, the monitor hypothesis, and the input hypothesis, among many others, have been crucial in shaping modern approaches to language teaching and learning. Dr. Krashen is also a strong advocate for bilingual education and has influenced educational policy and practice with his extensive research. With over 500 publications to his name, his work covers a wide range of topics, including neurolinguistics and literacy. It's a real privilege and honor to have Dr. Krashen here with us, and I cannot wait to dive into our conversation about language acquisition and perhaps the benefits of a good coffee. Dr. Krashen, welcome to Growing with Proficiency, the podcast, and thank you so much for accepting my invitation.
Oh, my pleasure. Cheers.
So cheers with our cafecitos here. And I know that you love cafecito. Where is that love for coffee started?
I will tell you the story. I was born in 1941. Okay. Uh-huh. Long time ago. During that time, people thought coffee was bad for you. And my mother had coffee, one cup every morning, which my father brought to her, of course. And my sister and I were very worried. Mom, you're drinking too much coffee. I had no coffee until I was 22 years old.
Oh, nothing. My goodness.
I was teaching in Ethiopia.
Uh-huh.
And I came to school one day and I was completely sleepless. I was going to say shit-faced, but I shouldn't say that. I was completely out of it. And one of the teachers was serving coffee in her classroom. I said, now is the time. I had a double espresso, my first coffee. I woke up. I have to tell you, before that, my life was a disaster. I had flunked out of school, I think, twice. I didn't know what I wanted to do. After that, success after success after success. As you know, research and honors and all this. And it's all because of coffee.
I know. Isn't that great? It's like the best thing. I cannot start my day without the coffee, plus the smell and everything. So I hear you and I share that love for coffee. And I also share the love that you have for languages. And I just want to start this conversation with something that I need to ask you, because you're the architect of comprehensible input theory, the hypothesis that after many, many years, people are not saying is hypothesis anymore, is a fact. So tell us a little bit about what comprehensible input is and what is its crucial role for language acquisition.
Okay, let me first tell you, I wrote a paper called Who Invented Comprehensible Input? And I started out by saying I'm the author of the paper, but I didn't invent it. Was there before me. I think Frank Smith got it first. He was in literacy. And he said that pleasure reading means all the things you want. It's going to be all the language you want, all the knowledge you want, et cetera. So I wrote that paper. It was only one page long, but I'm glad I did it because it's everybody's idea. I think it's the best thing that ever happened. I can brag about it because it's not my idea. It's going to make life easier for everybody.
Absolutely right. It has really made things easier in so many aspects, especially in one. I think as many teachers, we have found ourselves in this predicament of trying to teach grammar. And we go with the lesson and we really invest time trying to create an incredible PowerPoint. And then we just don't see the effects. And that's why your work has created such a great impact in so many language teachers like me around the world.
Let me make one little addition to that. People do grammar partly because they love it. They think it's interesting. That's me too. I had to overcome this. My PhD is in grammar, syntax. One of my heroes is Noam Chomsky. When I see a good grammatical description, I get very excited. So I understand people when they say, I love grammar, but it's not the answer. And I was disappointed as well.
You're absolutely right. I was so disappointed. But then I discovered your theory about comprehensible input and this big concept of I plus one. Tell us a little bit about that concept of I plus one.
Well, the idea of I plus one means what you want is input that's, number one, interesting. And a better word than interesting is compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Compelling means it's so interesting, you're not even aware of what language you're listening to or reading. You're fascinated by the message, okay? That's the main point. Comprehensible input is interesting. And for it to work, there has to be a lot of it, okay? You get lost in the book, get lost in the conversation. So we're looking for good books, good stories, etc. So listening to stories and reading for pleasure. I want to share with you what happened with me in Spanish. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't very good in Spanish. I like doing languages. I'm pretty good in French, German, a whole bunch of others. And I like to show off. I'm not shy. But Spanish, I went to the local grocery store about 2 years ago, and they had a new policy of opening the store very early in the morning. So I was there very early in the morning because I'm old now and I get up early. And the person working there was new, and they've got a lot of new people. And his name was Jose. I saw it written there. So of course I spoke to him in my bad Spanish, and he said, "We have a rule here. You must speak English with the customers, no matter what." So I continued in Spanish, of course. I said, Jose, tú puedes ayudarme, okay? Mi meta es hablar español como ustedes. He really liked me, just like you. Hablamos español. Since then, we've been speaking Spanish, and I have become a celebrity at the store.
I imagine.
Yeah, he told everybody, this man speaks 10 languages, not true. They all come up to me. They speak Spanish to me. They ask questions about linguistics. It's wonderful. But I'm better now. I'm much better at talking to Jose, not from talking to Jose. Here's the main point. He doesn't have time to talk to me more than like 60 seconds. He has other customers. I'm getting better because when I go home, I've been reading in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Been reading easy books for beginning Spanish to students. I've read this many books. And I'm still reading them easy books. I have favorite authors. Adriana Ramirez is my favorite. I have her students read her stuff. It's very good. I've been reading them in Spanish. I read them in Mandarin. I read them in Chinese. Ayun Lu, my Mandarin teacher. And now I can have a basic conversation in Mandarin because of these books.
Wow, that's incredible.
So it's reading that makes things happen. Conversation is wonderful. If you can fill your class with interesting conversation, absolutely yes. Reading is what's going to push us forward, I think. Reading for pleasure. Now I'm on the topic and you're too polite to interrupt me. Let me talk about it more. Reading in other languages, reading in any language, does three things. Number one, it gives you language.
Mm-hmm.
Major source of vocabulary, grammar, all those things. A writing style is reading for pleasure. And I have hundreds of articles about this and they're in the book that you picked up already. And I do recommend one more time that you read it, 2004. Don't buy it. It's too expensive. Get it used. You can get it for under $2, please. It's too much money going into these things, okay? So number one, you get language. Number two, people who read more know more.
Mm-hmm.
They know more about everything. The big article was done by Stanovich and Cunningham back in 1993, one of the best articles ever written in our profession. They know more about language. They know more about history. They know more about economics. They know more about geography. They know more about everything. They also found that people who got good grades in school knew more, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
Is better than study.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Wow.
For pleasure, it's better than studying hard in school. Studying hard in school is okay. Go ahead. But the answer is reading for pleasure. So the answer there is reading and the magic word, libraries.
Mm-hmm.
Let's support our libraries filled with lots of good books.
Mm-hmm.
These are under attack now.
I know.
This business of banning books, they might have homosexual things in them, all this nonsense. The reason is, I think, that they're afraid of losing money.
Mm-hmm.
If children get their books from libraries, they're not going to buy books.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So let's support libraries, and we're supporting our students. Okay.
When you're talking about reading, Dr. Krashen, you said that we need to go with easy reading. We need to, in language classrooms, we need to really focus on getting our students to do that easy reading. Tell us why it's so important, because I teach IB, I teach AP, and many times we found ourselves trying to bring the authentic book, the authentic article, and we see the struggle, right? Like, it's the struggle is huge. So I want you to like share with us your insights about that. Like, let's do it easy, because we want to have the rigor in our school, and we feel like rigor has to be hard, difficult. We need to suffer for that. So I would love for you to share that with you.
Yes, of course, you are right. Rigor is irrelevant. What we want is interest, being mm-hmm. absorbed in the book so the world disappears around you. The next question that comes up is, how do we get students involved in books? Let me give you my background on this. I'm in favor of self-selected reading.
Mm-hmm.
Very important. When I was in secondary school, and this was back in the Chicago area, it was in English only, of course. And we had language arts. Language arts was all assigned reading. We read English literature. We read British literature. I did all the reading. I wrote all the essays. I passed all the tests. I don't remember a single book that I read in secondary school. Not one. Mm-hmm. They made no impact. The books that count are the ones that are self-selected. Let me tell you what my self-selected reading was in those days. Number one, comic books.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Spider-Man is one of the most interesting characters in American literature. A superhero with constant problems, okay? I read comic books, lots of them. I read baseball stories that were excellent. They were profound, philosophical, interesting characters, etc. And I eventually started reading science fiction. That's what I read. And what happened to me? I became an important scholar.
Mm-hmm.
Started out with comic books and baseball stories and science fiction. I have written several papers about baseball stories and science fiction and published them about how interesting they were and how much I learned. A friend of mine was my teacher once in school. Seymour Pearl. He was a student in the class. Seymour Pearl is a doctor. He was my doctor. That's right. And I told him this idea. I said, we really want kids to select their books, easy books, et cetera. And just because they seem easy could mean they're very, very important. And he said, this is true in medicine. When something seems easy, when something seems not important, and it's a patient with a disease that's easy to cure, be careful. Mm-hmm. Make sure you get it right. Be impeccable, etc. This is what I learned from reading Easy Things. You get a lot out of these easy things.
Of course, because I guess you are going to be, I mean, it happens to us. Like you said, it happens to all of us. When it's too complicated, we just check out. We just move our eyes, but we don't really read. We don't comprehend. Now, some people, again, because I teach AP and I teach IB, and I've been, you know, going to all these conferences about AP and IB and advanced placement. And one of the things that we stress a lot in that upper levels is academic language. So when we're reading easy books, when we're reading comic books, when we're reading picture books or books that we feel like easy, are they going to give us the academic language that we need?
Yes. Let me give you the name of my former student who and I regard as now one of my teachers. His name is Jeff McQuillan. Mm-hmm. The master, he was the student. Now he is the master. I am the student. Jeff McQuillan has done some remarkable papers. He has looked at so-called easy reading, lots of academic language, language that you need for subject matter. He looked, for example, at the 7 Harry Potter novels, mm-hmm. over 200 difficult academic words that appear enough times to be acquired. Mm-hmm. So easy reading has this stuff. That's how I got it. I got it through baseball stories and science fiction and comic books.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. Because I think for, you know, when you're talking about your findings about reading, for me, I'm thinking this is the answer. This is what all of us should be doing in our classes. We really need to be devoting a lot of time to reading. But then in our daily life and our textbooks and our, observation with administration, there are two things that start kind of like pulling. And it's the push for output and the push for grammar teaching. So tell us a little bit about how can we really focus on, I mean, like why, how reading is going to help us to that output and how we can give an explanation to that administrator that is coming and say, why are you not teaching all this grammar? Or that other teacher that says, you really need to be teaching the difference between predicate and imperfect.
You don't. If a student is a future linguist, grammar student, again, let me repeat, I love Noam Chomsky's work. I have read all of it. I've actually spoken to him. It was a great thrill. I think it's fantastic. Studying grammar is not the route to knowing grammar. The way to get it is to do self-selected reading that you love and do a lot of it, and you will get all the academic language, all the vocabulary, all the grammar that you need. This is what McQuillan's study has shown us. And that's how we did it. That's how I did it. Mm-hmm. I didn't get excited about grammar until I was in college. But I had all that stuff before because of the pleasure reading I did in elementary school, secondary school. Again, for me, science fiction, comic books, etc.
Oh, yes. And I know that because that's what we see it. I remember still, Dr. Krashen, when my son was born here in the United States, and he was like in sixth grade, English, and he had to start taking grammar lessons in his English class. And it was something about the indirect object pronoun, direct object pronoun. And he just looked at me with this face and say, I just don't get what I need to know all these words for this. I understand what they're saying. Like, this is so, like, it was killing his love for reading because his English class was becoming a grammar class. And he's like, I don't want to do this. I just don't feel like it's necessary to do this. And he was able to speak his English. He was able to write in English. He was reading in English. He just didn't know all the words and the terms, but he knew English. So it's kind of like, why we're so obsessed about the importance of teaching grammar if, like you said, we're not linguists, they're not going to be a linguistic at any point.
I would offer linguistics as a subject mm-hmm. in high school and college as an elective. It's where you read Chomsky and you get all of it. And most students, when it's presented that way, will like it. Because it's Chomsky is one of the great geniuses of all time. It's wonderful reading his stuff, and I recommend it. But you have to be, it's not the route to grammatical accuracy. The route to grammatical accuracy and good writing is lots of reading. By the way, the research is quite strong on the effect of libraries. If you if you're in a neighborhood where this is a very good school and a good school library with a good collection and a professional librarian who understands how to order the books that children like, reading scores are higher. I have to add an important personal footnote, confession. I am prejudiced here. My daughter is a public librarian, okay? And we have wonderful conversations. I have succeeded.
I remember in Power of Reading, in that book, I read something that really kind of like opened my eyes. And you were talking about the crisis of literacy in the United States. And you were talking about how when we go to kindergarten or first grade, teachers start doing this spelling or the keywords and the spelling words. And you said if a kid has been read by their parents since they were little kids, they were going to have more success, not because they study, but because they were read. And that is the case of my children. My children were read since they were little and they went to the spelling test and they were, you know, having A's. And it's not because they study, it's because they read the words.
Good. Let me add something here. Stimulated a memory, something I should. Hearing stories from parents. When you ask children, do you like it when mommy and daddy tell you stories or read you stories? Nearly 100% say yes. Okay. The ones who don't like it are the ones whose parents don't like to do it. Okay. Which is very strange to me because it's wonderful. We also have found that introducing stories into language classes works very well. One of my colleagues, Beniko Mason, has done a series of studies on her method, which she uses for English as a foreign language in Japan. When the students come to class, they don't know any English. Class is story time. The teacher prepares stories to tell them stories in English. She draws pictures on the board. Here's a man. Here's a woman. They live in a house, blah, blah, blah. After an entire semester of that, they're introduced to easy books. And here's how she does it. By then, the books are comprehensible because they've heard so many stories. They have a lot of grammar, a lot of vocabulary. The first day of reading class, they come into the room. There's a big table filled with comprehensible, easy books. Okay. Mm-hmm. The students go around the table and look at the books, browse to see which ones they like. They can try them. They can put them back. When they start a book, they're not required to finish it. Her scores, we've published papers on it, are spectacularly good. I would combine stories, parents reading stories, teachers reading stories, and self-selected reading. And you have solved the problem of basic language acquisition.
I totally agree with you. As a matter of fact, Dr. Krashen, I just had a conversation with Dr. Alberta Gatti, and Alberta Gatti is doing something for heritage speakers, and she is having this new model, and the new model has three components, and it's for heritage speakers who have acquired the language. And the first component is extensive reading. So it's all the students are going to select a book and they're going to read a book or several books. The second component is more narrow reading where they, and I love this, when they look at the book and they kind of like talk about how others write. Because when you read, you're not only reading for understanding, but you also get to see how others write, which is why your writing is going to improve by reading. And it's like so kind of like common sense, but we just don't do it enough in our classes. And another thing that you mentioned, and I've heard you saying this, and this is like so relevant to me, is that reading has more effects than, you know, improve spelling, improve vocab, learning grammar, learning writing. And it's talking about empathy and just kind of like becoming better human beings. Tell us a little bit about your findings about that and what you have discovered about that aspect of reading.
Well, I'm going to ignore your question and talk about heritage language because you mentioned it, because it's so exciting. We all know the problem of heritage language. Mm-hmm. Children come to school, they know their primary language, talking to their abuelos, talking to their parents and all that. They come to school and it's all English. Mm-hmm. Heritage language nearly disappears, okay? We have two studies, one done by Lucy Say, one by Grace Cho. They come to the same conclusion. When you get heritage language students interested in reading for pleasure in the heritage language, they become fully bilingual.
Oh, yeah.
That is the solution to heritage language.
Then they I have that question so many times, Dr. Krashen, like, how can we do with heritage learners? So you have the answer.
Yep.
Read more.
Well, I'll tell you about Grace's study, Grace Cho. She is a Korean English bilingual teacher. She also speaks Spanish. She's quite something. Grace lives in a neighborhood where there's lots of Korean Americans. She went to a party once and she talked to all her neighbors and she found that everyone there spoke pretty good Korean. Wow. Mm-hmm. And some of them had spent their entire lives in the United States. Very little time in Korea. How did they do it? They became pleasure readers.
Wow.
And their Korean was beautiful. It was fine. Some of them had never been to Korea, had no education in Korean, just read for pleasure. How about that?
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That is incredible. And it's so important because, as you said, I think heritage learners have been losing their language. Incredible. And then we're not doing a good job inside our language classes when we get these heritage learners and we're trying to teach them ser and estar. What benefit can be for a heritage learner to learn how to conjugate the verb ser and the verb estar? So, yes, I truly agree with that. And I just relate to that because I have two heritage learners in my house. And one of the things that I push every day is we need to read in Spanish. That is the key for success.
We need to make the books available first. Mm-hmm. Books, magazines, and comic books.
Dr. Krashen, you post in Facebook a few weeks ago, a few months ago, something that it really kind of, I don't know, I was like, this, we need to talk about this. And you talk about why is that your work have been many, many years already in the public. Your findings, comprehensible input, how we need to acquire the language by reading, by listening, by having this language that we don't need to like teach these grammar lessons. But still, inside language classrooms, 90% don't do that. And you mentioned that we still don't understand the difference between learning and acquisition.
Exactly right.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what is that difference and why it's so important for us to really grasp that concept?
The reason, of course, is financial.
Mm-hmm.
Learning, very few people know about it. For most people, learning is the only way to do things. It's all they know. But no one is pushing acquisition. Only a few of us teachers, a few of us researchers are in favor, okay? Acquisition is free.
Mm-hmm.
It's called libraries.
Mm-hmm.
You don't make money on it. That's the big reason why. That's why you don't hear publicity pushing acquisition, you hear it pushing workbooks and drills and methods because it makes so much money. So we need more people like you and me saying, here's the research and you shouldn't ignore it. It's there.
And I think one of the biggest things that you have contributed to our profession is your research. Can you tell us a little bit about where we can find your research? Because I know that buying an article of research, first of all, I have to have a PhD before I understand one of those articles, honestly. And that's why I love your work. And I also love the work of Dr. Bill Van Patten, because it just put it in words that are accessible to teachers like me that don't have a PhD. But tell us a little bit more about how we can get that research in the hands of more teachers.
I really don't know. That's a wonderful question, and I've been asking the same one. How to make it more comprehensible.
Absolutely.
And first of all, if you want to put your article out so people will read it, they have to buy it. They have to buy, look at expensive journals. I don't subscribe to journals anymore. I can't afford it.
Yeah, they're expensive.
I'm not rich. I'm okay, but I'm not rich. Okay. I only subscribe to one journal. It's called Language Magazine because it's only $25 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And they publish articles for, against both sides. So okay. I like to put things there. And I like to put it in places where it's free to post. There's several places like that. That's a big problem. So what we can do about it is people like you read an article, you like it, you say something, you post it somewhere where people can read it, you cite the paper where they can find it, where they can download it, etc. But I don't have a big solution to this. It's still a major problem. The problems too is with the researchers. My colleagues, even the ones I like a lot, their articles are much too long.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
My colleagues have to learn how to write shorter and clearer papers. I wrote a paper on that, why we need to write shorter papers. Okay. It's not the fault of the teachers. It's the fault of the writers.
Yes. So
more researchers to write short, simple papers. And I'm happy to say that a few scholars do that. Jeff McQuillan does it. Bill Van Patten does it, et cetera. More and more need to do it. Nushan Ashtari does it, my colleague. That's the way to go.
And I agree that I just believe that is the in essence of our own existence as language classes, because we have been seeing traditional teaching for so long and we don't see the proficiency that we see at the end. And more states are moving to coding classes because we don't see the results in language classes. We don't see, like, after 4 years, students cannot say a word in the language or write or understand a reading. So, like, after 4 years, I better do coding. So I just truly believe that your work has been so influential in so many teachers. So just to finish, tell us a little bit of what you've been working on these days. I know that you're retired, enjoying good life, drinking good coffee, but I don't know if you've been working in something new or like just new research.
Always looking for new research, and I've kind of gotten an idea.
Okay.
I'll tell you about my experiences. I'm curious to know yours. I learned to speak German when I was in Austria for about a year, but that was 40 years ago, okay? And I went to a local pharmacy. The clerk there had a German accent, so I answered her in German. And she said, how long have you been here? She thought I was a speaker. Very nice. I hadn't spoken German in at least 20 years.
Oh, wow.
The same thing with French. I've been sitting in on a French class lately. A friend of mine wants me to do it, and it's a lot of fun. And I've been chatting too, and I found I can still speak French. And most of my French comes from time spent in Ottawa in Canada. Mm-hmm. I worked in a French program years ago, and it's still there. Why? My hypothesis is if you have acquired the language, it is there forever.
Oh.
If you have learned it, it disappears very quickly. And I'm looking for more case histories if this has happened to other people.
Absolutely. And I think you have a great point to the fact of my own children. So when they were born here in the United States. They are in high school, so they don't see me much. I'm the only person that talks to them in Spanish. Mm-hmm. They go to the school, and a few summers ago, I was gone, and they were here with their dad, and their dad speak English. And then I came back and I was just talking to them, and it was like nothing was lost.
Right.
Like everything right. was there. And right. and what is even more is whenever they go to Colombia with me, like the first day or two is kind of rough. Like they kind of like get lost a little bit. By the third day, there is back all. Like everything is back, and this they can use the language, they can understand the language. And I love that comment, because one of the things that a lot of teachers say is like, we need to teach grammar because they look in the assessment, you know, like I teach the verb to like, gustar, and then I have them to write a little text, and then they're going to write it and it looks really, really good. But if I don't teach it, then it doesn't look that good. And I say, but then after 6 months, it's lost. Like, it's, like oh, six
That's
right. months is too much. Two
That's
weeks
exactly
is
right.
gone.
Let's collect examples like this. I have another interesting hypothesis. I'll tell you the story about this. I was in Ethiopia, and the language in Ethiopia is Amharic, which is an Arabic-related language. And I picked up Amharic from a bad speaker.
Oh.
Another American, Brian McCauley, I would like to contact him and thank him. We used to go out having beer together, and I would hear him speak terrible Amharic, okay? And that's what I acquired. And that allowed me to understand more Amharic. And it's still with me. It was good. There's nothing wrong with bad language. That's what I'm beginning to think. I got it from him. I got lots of vocabulary from him. Not beautiful. But today, this is 60 years later, I can still speak bad Amharic.
Interesting.
At an Ethiopian restaurant, I can make jokes to the waiter, all that stuff.
Oh my gosh, that is so interesting, because a lot of teachers who are not native speaker teaching that language have a lot of concerns about like, oh my gosh, my accent or my mispronunciation of a word or maybe an error in whatever grammatical structure. So what you're saying is it really doesn't matter. You
nope.
can.
Yeah, exactly. Let me give you the advice of Stephen Kaufman, who is a polyglot. Steve acquired 10 languages between ages 60 and 70. Isn't that
wow?
Yes, he's something. He has great advice. Here's what he says. If you're a beginner, don't worry about mistakes. Nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is.
Nobody cares in the real world. So I speak my bad Amharic quite a bit of the time, okay? When I'm, you know, in an Ethiopian restaurant, or if I go to Kaiser, the people working there, some of them are Ethiopians. It's fine. Nobody cares if I make mistakes.
Nobody really cares. Oh,
nobody cares. Thanks to Kaufman.
Dr. Krashan, this was such a great conversation. I enjoy every second. I learn from you so much. I still learning from you so much. I keep reading your book, The Power of Reading. Is such a great book. You said you advise people don't buy it new, buy it used, but buy it, because it's a really great book about reading and the power of reading. Dr. Krashan, thank you so much for coming to Growing with Proficiency, the podcast today.
Pleasure is mine. El gusto es mío. Okay.